all one word.
Welcome to Street Science,
where we discuss science and its effects on your health,
your life,
and the planet.
Neutron, proton, mass defect, lyrical oxidation, your irrelevant mass spectrograph, your electron volt, atomic energy, erupting as I get all open on betatrons, gamma rays, thermal cracking, cyclotron, any and every mic you're on, trace uranium, if you're always uranium, molecules, spontaneous combustion.
Yes, welcome to Street Science. Another Wednesday is here, and we are glad to be in the studio and bringing you the best program that money can buy.
Of Street Science here on 104.6 Planet Earth.
So this is Charles, and of course I have in the studio other presenters.
Hi, good day, everyone.
Yeah, Andrew.
Yeah.
And Blue.
Hello, Charles. Hi, Andrew. It's good to have the original three of us back here.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's been a while. And it's good to have our listeners, you know, listening to us here on Planet FM 104.6 or even in Masterton, Arrow FM listeners have a chance to listen to this program too.
That's right.
So we really want to welcome them to, you know, to listen to this interesting show for this evening. And how about we give a shout out to our sponsors, MediRay. MediRay has been doing a very good job, you know, giving us what it takes to run this show, and I think they have done that remarkably. We just want to say to the guys, thanks for you know, supporting us, and we give a shout out to your company. You guys are involved in health and science, you know, selling stuff about health and science, and I'm sure people will continue to make your business grow. All right, so today we have a show. We have somebody from Wellington who will be joining us soon.
Yep, that's right.
And how do you pronounce it?
The name is, I hope we're pronouncing correctly, Robert Vinecove, who's a doctor, both a clinician and a researcher, actually.
And also a researcher. So Rob will be joining us from Wellington shortly, and he's a real doctor. I mean, he finishes medicine and then went into this specialty that he's been talking about.
Yeah,
we don't want to give him away.
Okay,
All right, so we'll keep it there. But hey, what the topic is something that you'll be interested in. I think we can tell people what we're going to talk about. It's about how his job is in the area of hematology, right?
Yeah, he's a hematologist.
Yes.
Yeah.
And basically to do with a disease of the blood. So if you have a relative or yourself, you know, with any condition to do with the blood, then I'm sure this talk with Dr. Robert Vinecove will be very interesting to you. What do you think, Blue?
Yeah, it sounds like it'll be good to have a chat with Robert and hear a little bit about his work. And I'm interested to learn a bit more about hematology today.
Yeah, and it's really good to see New Zealand researchers getting involved in this area, because I guess it's an area where a lot of big players and overseas and stuff are getting involved in terms of these, you know, targeting diseases like leukemia and stuff, pretty serious illnesses which don't have a good prognosis. So it's really good to see New Zealand researchers getting involved in this sphere and doing some pretty cutting-edge stuff by the look of it.
Yeah, but before he comes in, he works for this research institute. In fact, I don't think I know much about
No. They're kind of the quiet achiever of New Zealand science.
Yeah.
It's called the Mulligan Institute, right?
Mulligan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they have a centre here in Auckland, right? And they have one in Wellington.
I don't know about Auckland, but Wellington. They're based in Wellington.
Oh, they're based in Wellington.
Yeah, yeah. So, which is probably being in Auckland why we don't hear about them, because we only care about what happens in Auckland.
So, Dr. Robert Vinecove will be talking to us from Wellington by phone. So we apologize in advance if, you know, the sound is not as perfect as it used to be, or if even the line doesn't, you know, go through well for us, we apologize for that in advance. But I'm sure he will join us very soon while we throw in this song from my main man about the immune system.
Can you say it?
Sounds good.
Sounds good.
Plan to protect you from dangerous pathogens that try to infect you. New layers of defense keep the germs away. Letting us live yet another day. Skin and mucus membranes first, then innate defenses. Defending off invaders have future offenses. Then specific responses with lymphocytes, B and T. Killer T is an assassin.
That would enter, and that is why we have to
when these killer T require activation by a phagocytic cell.
You and me are. Our body knows
it's there. Watch out for the pathogens that would enter, and that is why we have leukocytes, leukocytes. They brought them from you and me, our body. There are two branches, branches of immunity, humoral immune, re-resulting of us. Antibodies, cell-mediated is the other response, involves activation and clonal selection. Immune system protects us from the outside world that would come in. Our body knows how to keep us safe. I'm glad it's there. I'm glad it's there. I'm glad it's there. So glad it's there. I'm glad it's there. I'm glad it's there. Immune system protects us from the outside world that would come in. Our body knows how to keep us safe. I'm glad it's there.
Let antibodies and proteins be lymphocytes agree to bind with unique antigens and lead them to defeat. Both B's and T's can recognize specific pathogens through receptors on their membranes that bind with antigens. A B cell receptor is made of four polypeptide chains, which forms a kind of Y. The stem is stuck into the membrane. Two other chains are heavy, two other chains are light. The two tips of the Y form the antigen binding sites. Activated B cells secrete their receptors as antibodies. They are system's number one protector. Random recombining within B and T receptor genes generates amazing receptor shape diversity. The staggering assortment of B and T receptors lets us recognize specific invaders when they enter. T receptors are quite different, but their function is the same. They combine with almost any antigen that can be named. They're just two chains, and right at their tip is the specific shape that binds invaders in their grip. T cells come in two main varieties. The helper T's the general in the immune system army, and cytotoxic killer T cells, they're assassins. They kill our zombie cells controlled by viral pathogens.
It's the immune system, sworn to protect you from dangerous pathogens that try to infect you. Three layers of defense keep the germs away. Letting us live yet another day.
Okay. So thank you for listening. You are listening to Street Science, coming to you live from 104.6 Planet FM. And we have Dr. Robert Wenkov online. So,
yeah, hi, Robert. How are you?
Hello. Good, thank you. Hello,
Glad you could get back to us. So you're working at the Mulligan Institute down in Wellington. And could you tell us just quickly just a little bit about it? Because I guess a lot of people in Auckland might not be aware of the work you're doing down there. Just a brief interview.
Yeah, certainly. So I'm actually a clinician and a scientist. So I'm a hematologist, a blood specialist by training, with expertise in treating leukemias and lymphomas. And I work at the Mulligan Institute, which is actually named after Len Mulligan, who founded Tip Top Ice Cream. And it's got a bit of a mission as an institute, really, to try and bring immunology into the clinic and to try and help people's lives through harnessing the power of the immune system. One of the key research programs we have is looking at immune therapy or immune treatments for cancers.
Right, okay, so it's a pretty cutting edge area of research that you're working in. So why did you choose hematology? It's probably one of the most complicated branches of medicine, isn't it?
It does get quite complicated, but I think so can everything else. I actually, when I was training, wrote a list of all the specialties down and crossed off all the ones I didn't want to do and found this one was left called hematology, and I went and found out some more about it, and I found it a fascinating and very rewarding specialty to work in.
That sounds like how I did my degree, actually. That sounds really familiar. Maybe...
Yeah. Hi, Robert. This is Charles here.
Hi, Charles.
Yeah. Hello. So I think that's interesting. I was reading your bio on the Mulligan Institute webpage, and I read that how you got into hematology. So you were basically one choice away from changing career. Would you say that?
Yes, I did. I did look at various career options, but I'm glad I chose what I did.
Yeah. Okay. So I wanted to. I know you interact with like people who come to the clinic who are ill and their families as well. So you know how to communicate to our audience who are not really scientists, but you know people on the street. So yeah. The immune system. I mean, how would you describe that to say the family of, you know, the sick people that you see? I mean, if you were to describe this term immune system to them, how would you put it? Just so that people will be on the people listening to us.
Well, the immune system is not just one thing. It's like a sort of army of soldiers inside our bodies that are prepared there to protect us against things like infections, viruses, bacteria, but also to protect their own bodies against things that go wrong inside our bodies. So one thing we now really understand is that the immune system can play an important role in protecting us against developing cancerous changes inside cells.
Okay, so basically you work on something called immunotherapy. A lot of people are probably familiar with getting immunized against something like polio or hepatitis. So how would you describe this particular treatment? How does it work? What's the main principle of immunotherapy?
Well, there are quite a lot of different ways that we use immune therapy now in cancer treatments as a whole. And I guess it's conceptual, really. When we've first thought about cancer, we thought about, well, if there's a cancer there, we cut it out, and that remains one of the key modalities of treatment today. And then we thought about, well, let's try and damage the cancer with chemotherapy and radiotherapy, try and damage the genetic information within the cancer cells and make them die by directly sort of accosting them that way. What's emerged particularly recently is that you can also either arm patients' immune systems, or sort of activate patients' immune systems to allow the patient's own immune system to attack the malignant cell. And there's a variety of different ways that we can do that. Some of them have been in use for quite a long time, and we now understand better how they work. Mm-hmm. And some of them are quite new treatments, some of which we're working on here at the Maligan Institute, among other research institutes.
Okay, so is this a pretty new area? I mean, this is something, I guess, like you said, that traditionally people have treated cancer with surgery or chemotherapy. How new is immunotherapy?
It's not as new as you might think. Back in the 1930s, an American physician made a bit of a name for himself, not always a good one, by taking patients who had skin cancers and injecting live bacteria into patients' skin cancers. Wow. Now, this was in the era before we had regular antibiotics, so some people succumbed to the treatment.
Right.
But if some people have found, in some people, these cancers actually shrunk. And this is one of the first pieces of evidence that somehow activating the immune system, in this case with live bacteria, could actually act against a cancer. So since then, since William Coley's early experiments, we've learned a lot more about how to do that in, we hope, a much safer fashion. And we have much more targeted ways of activating people's immune system. And we also have a much better idea about what types of cancer are likely to respond to what types of immune therapy and which ones aren't likely to respond, because not all malignancies, not all cancers act in the same way.
So, Robert, Charles here. So we are talking about the immune system and you know, doing something for it to, you know, attack the cancer cells and so on. But we know that as we grow old, our immune system kind of also gets old and not as strong as when we were young. I just want to know whether this particular immunotherapy that we are talking about, for you, you see patients who are young and old as well. Do you think this will work better in young people because their immune system may be much stronger, if I should put it that way?
Yeah, it's a good question. And a lot of immune therapies do work better in younger people. One of the immune therapies that we use, one of the ones I've been talking about that's been in use for some time now, is in fact bone marrow transplantation, which we now recognize is effectively an immune system transplant. And we know that if you get your bone marrow transplant from a younger donor, that it's more likely to be successful. So that probably is one example of younger people having more active immune systems that are able to work more potently. But given that cancers get more common as we age, that's just one of the unfortunate facts of life, it's really important that any therapies that we come up with work in older people as well as in younger people. And indeed, many of the new treatments do seem to work very effectively in older people as well.
So you have mentioned bone marrow transplant. There are other types as well, correct? There are other antibody
That's right. Yeah. So I guess there's several different ways of thinking about immune therapies. One of them is some of the antibody therapies that we've had for a long time, and these work in one of a couple of different ways. Some of them work by latching onto the cancer cells and basically labeling them, putting a little flag on the cancer that says to the patient's immune system, I'm here, come and attack me. And so those are types of immune therapy that have actually been around with us for the treatment of certain lymphomas since the 90s. And then for breast cancer, you might have heard of a drug called Herceptin. That's one of the ways that that drug works. Then there are much more targeted therapies and newer therapies. One of them, which has recently come to light and has really had a lot of publicity, is what we call checkpoint blockade. And this is a type of treatment that works as given as an injection once every few weeks, and it basically unleashes the immune system. The immune system, when it comes in to try and attack something like a cancer cell, will come in and try and attack it, but as soon as it starts attacking, the immune system puts on the brakes again and steps back, and that's one of our body's systems to stop our immune system overreacting to anything that we come across in our day-to-day life. Well, these checkpoint blockade drugs, it's like they cut the brake lines and allow the immune system to just act without the brakes and really act more strongly against the cancer. And I think even many researchers in the field are quite surprised at how successful some of those treatments have been in certain types of cancer, and in particular for the cancer called skin cancer called melanoma, where they've proved very effective indeed. And I think that just provides a really good proof of principle that doing something as seemingly straightforward as unleashing the immune system can actually lead to substantial and long-lasting regression or shrinkage of tumours. Some of those treatments are now funded for certain patients in New Zealand, and people are getting those.
It's exciting.
So I guess if you're taking the brakes off the immune system, is there any danger you could trigger an autoimmune response by doing that? I guess you're upregulating your body's response against these cancer cells.
You're absolutely right. You can, and that does happen. And maybe 1 in 5, 1 in 10 people might get quite serious immune reactions, and those can range from things that are quite easily dealt with, like immune reactions against the thyroid gland, where the patient can just take a thyroid tablet to replace that, to potentially life-threatening reactions like reactions that affect the lung and cause shortness of breath. There's a lot of experience that's been developed now with these drugs, and there are quite particular protocols for dealing with these types of reactions if they happen, stopping the drug, giving other treatments to immune suppress the patient. And so it's very important that the oncologists and other physicians who are using these drugs or are seeing patients who are treated with these drugs, they're aware of these potential reactions and aware of the ways that they can go about treating them.
Okay. And I also noticed from doing a little bit of background reading that one of the key mediators in immune reactions are these things called T cells. And there's this thing that called CAR T cells, which are, I think, are like an engineered T cell. Do you guys work in that area? Is that something that?
Yeah. So that is something we're beginning to work on here. So the one of the key immune cells that has the ability to learn and acquire the ability to destroy cancer cells are these cells called T cells. And they're really important, a really critical part of the immune system for us. And an approach that's really been pioneered over the last 10 years is to take out patients' own T cells and then to genetically engineer them, to retarget them against cancer cells. Yeah. And one of the reasons that I'm involved as a blood specialist in this immunology institute is that this type of treatment has proved extremely promising for certain types of leukemia and lymphoma, which are diseases that I treat. So we are not currently offering any CAR T-cell therapies, but we are working with an overseas group and developing some protocols with a view to establishing a trial here in New Zealand. These approaches at the moment are still investigational. They're not licensed or regularly used in any country in the world just yet, although it's possible in the next year or two they might be. So we are looking at bringing that approach to New Zealand and hopefully treating patients here in the coming couple of years. So yeah, those are very exciting treatments, very advanced, obviously given they involve genetic engineering and some quite sophisticated techniques. There's a huge amount of regulation, a huge amount of safety process need to be put in place. But we're very excited about that prospect.
Yeah, Robert, we all work in an area of science that whenever we mention genetic and engineering in the same sentence, it raises red flags in terms people's perception and so on. So I'm just wondering whether in this particular area that we just described, the CAR T cells involving genetic engineering somebody's T cells to fight cancer, do you anticipate any pushback from, you know, who I'm talking about? I mean, people who are not really into, you know, accepting genetic engineering?
So,
or genetic
I hope not. And the reason is this, that the one person's immune cells, if I took some your immune cells and put them into my body, they'd be immediately rejected. Mm. And that's because we all have different immune systems, we all have different tissue types, and unless it was such an extremely rare circumstance of one in a million chance that we actually got the same immune system, we wouldn't, the immune cells, if they went from one person to another, couldn't propagate. They can't exist outside the body without dying straight away, and they can't be transmitted from one person to another. So perhaps somewhat unlike some of the things where people do get very concerned, like around changing crops or foodstuffs, there's no risk of a cell getting from one person to the next person. So that's one very important difference.
Okay.
The second very important difference is that when you do this, I said at the beginning that there are some extremely strict rules and regulations about the way that you do it. Those rules extend to having not just one, but usually three or four separate ways to ensure that the change cannot propagate even within the person that you give it to. So there are we're not looking here at brand new types of therapy. These have been done for quite a few years in other centers in the States and through Europe. We're looking at treatments that have been very refined and are now on their third generation of safety measures, having not caused any problems even in early generations. So the answer is this is quite distinct from something you're putting out into the environment, in that this can't propagate even if it tried to. And the second point is, even if it tried to, there's no possibility of it. So there's a number of fail-safes and checkpoints in there, but absolutely, the New Zealand regulatory system is very robust. It basically is modelled on the European regulatory system for these kinds of products. And for that reason, and the reason I'm being reticent about when we might do a trial like this, we have to make sure we've covered off all those risks and safety measures.
Okay, so I just want to throw in this quick before I pass it on to Andrew. So we know we have different types of cancer treatments around. Nobody can really predict how successful one or how good one is from the other. I'm just wondering whether is immunotherapy compared to chemo. About the side effects of when people are undergoing chemo treatment. We know how the pain they go through. Do you think that immunotherapy is a bit more less severe, if I should put it that way, on the body compared to chemotherapy?
It certainly can be. And I think all immune therapies have their own toxicities. There's no doubt about that. They can, as we talked about earlier, have immune side effects. They can have off-target effects, so they could activate, they could destroy other non-cancerous cells that are nearby but look similar to the immune system. Mm. What I would say is that the side effects of immune therapies differ, and they differ quite substantially to chemotherapies.
Mm.
And we call that non-overlapping toxicities. And that can be very useful, because the reality is that it's very unlikely that one specific treatment is going to work for every cancer. Much more likely is that what's happened so far is that as we get experience in various malignancies, we find that one modality of treatment works for one cancer, another works for another, another works for another, and for some malignancies you may have to combine two or three different modalities. For example, for lymphomas, our success so far relies on combining an antibody treatment with chemotherapy. But the fact we use the antibody treatment means the chemotherapy is more effective, and we don't necessarily need to give such big doses of the chemotherapy, so we reduce toxicity all round. So I think as we get more experience in these immunotherapies, and that is happening now extremely rapidly, we're going to find out how to use them optimally and find out how to use them without toxicity. So yes, it has the promise of potentially being less toxic, but more importantly perhaps the toxicity to differ, and that allows one to come up with rational combinations, and also perhaps to give different options if one person doesn't respond to one type of treatment because they get bad side effects. You know, you've got a different modality of treatment that works in a completely different way and shouldn't create those same types of side effects for that person.
So it's all about getting the right combination for the right people, I guess.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I know from within my own field that those combinations can differ extensively. One type of acute myeloid leukemia is treated, for example, in a completely different way to another. And we're recognizing that more and more. So part of this development really is some of the companion diagnostics and the ways that we diagnose and classify different malignancies, which have changed a lot in recent years, and I think are going to change a great deal more in the years to come.
Yeah, and I guess just to follow up on what Charles was saying about chemotherapy, I guess one of the key problems with chemotherapy is you get drug resistance when the cells pump the drug back out again, and it's hard to treat after that point. Is immunotherapy less susceptible to developing like resistance?
Yeah, well, it's certainly not susceptible to that type of resistance, but cancer cells can adopt a variety of methods by which they can become resistant to immunotherapy as well. So, for example, one of the CAR T-cell therapies that's been most successful is treating a type of B-cell leukemia, and basically the CAR T-cell therapy is where you take the T-cells and you redirect them against the B-cells. So there's a lot of acronyms there, but you're redirecting one type of immune cell against another. Well, a few patients have relapsed after that treatment because their malignant B cells have dropped the marker that the CAR T cell therapy was targeting. So yes, it's eminently feasible that tumor cells could evolve to become resistant. What I would say, to come back to an earlier example of melanoma, where this checkpoint blockade treatment has been very successful, as we accrue evidence of how these drugs work, we can look at how patients who are treated in the earlier trials have fared over time. And what does seem to be happening with the melanoma treatment is a large fraction of patients, I mean, not huge, but relatively large, maybe 20-30%, don't seem to have relapsed even after 5 or more years. And this is really significant because this suggests that fraction of patients may have been cured by that treatment, and then hopefully we have genuinely eradicated all the cells. And so that's really critical, because that's something, it's not everybody, but that's people who are able to get on with their lives, and this implies that we can perhaps build on that success by adding in additional treatments in a rational way.
So it looks quite promising, I guess, from that point of view. So just very quickly, we've just got time for just one quick question. So next 10 years or 20 years, what do you see as the most promising immunotherapy treatment coming over the horizon?
Oh, gosh. Well, yeah, well, I'm going to have to say CAR T cells, because we're working on that, developing a program around that at the moment, because I think that's really, really exciting. And I think that we'll find a bunch of new targets, and we'll find more sophisticated and cleverer ways of generating the CAR T cells. And we'll also hopefully be able to control them, because one of the benefits of being able to genetically modify the cells is that you can add off switches as well. So you can switch the cell on to attack the cancer, and you can add an off switch so that if the patient starts to get side effects, you can switch the cells back off again and destroy them. And that's a really fascinating area, and one in which I think we're all going to have to upskill and learn.
It sounds really fascinating. Great
awesome.
Stuff.
Yeah, Robert, we have really enjoyed this conversation, but unfortunately our time is up. So I'm sure our listeners will be so grateful for coming onto the program, and maybe one day we can get him
back on again.
Yeah, yeah, we'll get you back on again. Perhaps the next time you visit Auckland, we can bring you physically to the studio, and then we can have all the time to ourselves. Thank you so much for your time.
I'll be delighted. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
About the oxyribonucleic acid DNA. Fantastic.
The nitrogenous base is common in one of four varieties, known by the letters A, T, C, and G. A is for adenine, thymine's got the T. C, it stands for cytosine, guanine's got the G. A and G with two nitrogen rings of purine. C and T with one ring are pyrimidine. C only bonds with G, A only with T, because like puzzle pieces, they're complementary. They fit together, snuggled up like hand and glove, like enzymes and substrates, like people in love. ATCG matched up like lock and key, forming hydrogen bonds, either two or three. Hydrogen bonds, you know they aren't very strong, but they are enough.
Yeah, listeners, that was Dr. Robert Weinkopf. I need to get the name right, from Wellington, Maligan Institute. He's also a surgeon and a hematologist, in fact, and he came on to explain to us what immunotherapy is about. So next week, we are coming back again to the studio, and I'm sure that will be Blue and Ben, and perhaps Andrew, talking about something very more interesting. Oh, no, I shouldn't say that, but maybe something that we can, you know,
a little bit more lighthearted.
Yeah, yeah, like beer.
Or thirst quenching.
Yeah, yeah, like beer.